Welcome to Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. Hello, and welcome to another encouraging episode of Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. On today's podcast, we have an in-depth interview with Michael Colucci and Jan Ellen Graves of the Actors Workshop Theater. Also, Chicago critic Tom Williams will be bringing you four more encouraging reviews from the Chicago theater scene. And of course, as always, I will be bringing you the theater news. So buckle up, sit back, relax, and get ready to talk some theater. Hello, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago news podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of April 3rd, 2006. The Wrecking Ball will soon be coming down on the theater at 2851 North Halsted Street, which is currently the home for Comedy Sports. The theater, which was originally a bakery, played a very, very pivotal role for Chicago's off-loop theater scene. At one point, it was the home of the St. Nicholas Theater, where David Mamet was one of the co-founders, where then it became home to the Steppenwolf Theater, in between the time they were at the Jane Addams Hull House Theater and their current home at 1650 North Halsted. Afterwards, the Organic Touchstone Theater held residence there, and now currently Comedy Sports, the improv company. The Wrecking Ball is scheduled to come down this May, but right beforehand, there's going to be a fabulous farewell party on April 9th. That's right, from 1 to 4 o'clock at 2851 North Halsted. For a $25 ticket, you can enjoy one of the greatest farewell parties that the theater has ever known. Don't miss it. Leaving Iowa is coming back to Chicago. That's right, the critically acclaimed, hilarious family comedy written by Chicago playwrights Tim Clue and Spike Morton will be returning to Chicago for a six-week limited engagement run at the Royal George Theater. This family-friendly show features an original musical score by Bruce Roper of the popular Chicago folk trio Sons of the Never Wrong. This equity production will feature Brad Armacost, Denise Blank, Kelly Cooper, and Brian McCartney. Broadway diva Patti LuPone will once again be singing the words of Stephen Sondheim at the Ravinia Festival. This summer, LuPone will tackle the mother of all stage mothers, Mama Rose, in a staged concert of Gypsy, running August 11th through August 13th. Ravinia first embarked on its annual Stephen Sondheim Festival 6 years ago with a concert version of Sweeney Todd. But due to its extremely popular success, Ravinia has decided to continue the festival. For more information, call 847-266-5100. That's 847-266-5100. Reserve early. This is a guaranteed sellout. The LaSalle Bank Theater will be reopening its doors on May 24th at 7:30 with a concert by Broadway's original Phantom, Michael Crawford. The century-old theater is currently undergoing a 14-month-long, multi-million-dollar restoration. The tickets for this one-night-only concert will be available at 312-902-1400. Again, that's 312-902-1400. Rounding out the rest of the Broadway in Chicago's 2006-2007 season, the world premiere of The Pirate Queen, running October 3rd to November 26th, The Color Purple, opening in April of 2007, the Pulitzer Prize-winning Doubt will be playing the LaSalle Bank Theater from January 9th through January 28th. Also, George Wendt and Richard Thomas will be starring in 12 Angry Men at the LaSalle Bank Theater from January 30th through February 11th. And the backstage comedy Legends, running from February 20th through March 4th. Some off-season specials will be including the Billy Joel, Twyla Tharp dance musical Movin' Out, and Mamma Mia will be playing at the Cadillac Palace Theater from December 12th through December 31st. The Chicago Federation of Musicians Union is picketing the show The Tribute to Frank, Sammy, Joey, and Dean, the Nostalgic Rat Pack Showcase, currently playing at the Royal George Theater, saying that the producers have decided to not hire union musicians. The orchestra currently consists of 12 musicians, none of whom are operating under a union contract. But according to the show's co-producer, Dick Feeney, this is a non-union show. End of conversation. Porchlight Music Theater has announced its 2006-2007 season. The shows for this season include A Wonderful Life, a musical version of a classic movie by Sheldon Harnick, Assassins by Stephen Sondheim, a newer piece called The Teapot Scandal by John Steinhagen, and a revival of Ragtime. The entire season will be performed at the Theater Building Chicago, 1225 West Belmont Avenue. Don't miss it. Theater in Chicago has learned that Elaine Letronic and her son Brian Letronic will be leaving the Chicago Jewish Theater following the current run of Feathers in the Wind. Elaine is the founder and artistic director of the company, which currently performs at 5123 North Clark Street in Andersonville. The troupe had planned to relocate to a larger theater in Skokie for the 2006 and 2007 season, but they will no longer head that endeavor. According to an inside industry source, Elaine and Brian, who is currently the company manager, are dealing with family issues and exhaustion. No word on any replacement for either of the Letronics, although Elaine has offered suggestions of several possibilities to the board of directors. Elaine and Brian, thank you for a great run, and good luck on your future endeavors. This has been your Talk Theater in Chicago news podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.
Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's review podcast. Here's my review of Romance by David Mamet, directed by Pam McKinnon, at the Goodman Theater as part of the Mamet Festival. Romance is a wild, hilarious, extreme satire of the justice system. Romance is pure David Mamet as we have grown to know him. Gutsy, crude, blasphemous. He certainly rips everything in his path in Romance. The name is quite misleading. This is a courtroom drama gone crazy that ends up a farcical, satirical tirade that mocks the judicial system, judges, world politics, homosexuals, religious prejudice, ethnic hatred, and of course, lawyers. It mentions that Shakespeare was both Jewish and probably gay. It attacks with enough vulgar language and over-the-top physicality to make this 90-minute manic adventure seem like an X version of the Marx Brothers film. It is a hoot. David Mamet sure demonstrates his deft use of stinging dialogue in this insult-based comedy that is part Christopher Durang, part satire, and long on burlesque. Let me count the things Mamet mocks. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict, fidelity, world peace, Jews, gays, Catholics, podiatrists, chiropractors, the rule of law, courtroom procedures, and political correctness. All in this 90 minutes of mayhem set in a courtroom run by the pill-popping judge, played by Matt DiCaro, who steals the show with his wacky madness. This judge is the self-absorbed judge, and with his hard-nosed prosecutor, played by Steve Pickering, who is having trouble with his boy toy, John LaGuardia, and the anti-Semitic defense lawyer, played by Christian Stolte, whose client is the evasive Jewish chiropractor, played by David Pasquese. The calm bailiff, played by Ron O.J. Parson, tries to keep the judge on track as he witnesses the anarchy that erupts into slapstick in this absurdity of hate comedy as it unfolds. Mamet's trademark verbal dexterity and foul-mouthed wit are used in the extreme to produce the crude yet clever humor absolutely meant to offend many people. You know, Mamet is one of the few playwrights I know that can almost make using the F-word and foul language seem lyrical. But if the F-word and ethnic insults offend you, then romance isn't for you. But if you like biting humor, wonderfully played way over the top with a zest and skill, then you're going to like romance. It'll deliver for you. I laugh myself silly. Mamet's screwball comedy vividly shows us that we must solve our differences at home before we can tackle international problems. Mamet takes no prisoners in this no-holds-barred farce. This is a brilliant work that will make you laugh. It's Romance, the Goodman Theater. My rating for this show, highly recommended. The Goodman Theater is located at 170 North Dearborn in Chicago. The play runs as part of the Mamet Festival that is running for 7 weeks at the Goodman Theater. The schedule is Tuesdays and Wednesdays at 7:30, Thursdays at 7:30, Fridays at 8, Saturdays at 2 and 8, Sundays at 2 and 7:30. The show runs 90 minutes with no intermission, and it runs through April 23rd. For more information, call 312-443-3800. That's 312-443-3800. You are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's review podcast. Talk to you next time. Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's review podcast. Here is my review of Urinetown the Musical. Music and lyrics by Mark Hallman, directed by Tom Mullen, musical direction by Michael Sobey, produced by Blue Dog Entertainment at the Mercury Theater. Urinetown the Musical glows at the intimate Mercury Theater. Some shows need to be marketed to a specific audience, and Urinetown is sure one of those. It appeals to the same 20 or 30-something crowd that the House Theater Chicago has cultivated. These folks like savvy, satirical, over-the-top, fresh, toe-tapping comic musicals. Urinetown, the winner of 3 Tony Awards, provides all of that and more. It also works best in the intimate 300-seat Mercury Theater. This could be the right show at the right venue at the right time. That is a formula for success. There is nothing like it anywhere. Urinetown is a fresh, hilarious spoof of the Brechtian epic theater and of Wellian stretch of operatic form. The result is a fresh, original, colorful, surprising musical. This show is nothing but fun. Urinetown proves once again that almost any topic is grist for the mill of the talented musical composers and lyricists. This exuberant show will leave you basking in the glory of the stage's power to entertain. Urinetown is a product of the Fringe Festival in New York City. It is simply the story of 2 kids who fall in love in the city in the middle of a water shortage. It spoofs political corruption, corporate greed, and the social consequences of mismanaged environment. Classic left-wing issues such as exploitation and abuse of the poor and organized resistance versus terrorism are explored in this irreverent, campy style that is pure Bertolt Brecht, as the characters stay aloof and at times step out of character and even speak to the audience, all in good fun. These techniques and a fabulously energetic and melodious score amounts to a winning show. We hear an original score chock full of references to the Threepenny Opera, to the Cradle Will Rock, and the Depression era big extravaganza musicals. The wonderful choreography by Brian Lofer is true to the original Broadway production. Sometimes the dances imitate Fosse or Jerome Robbins. Sometimes they're a march. Sometimes spectacularly frantic chaos. A lot of people running around and climbing up and down the two-tiered set. But theatrically, it becomes a thrill. Movement is paramount in the show, with terrific choral singing to underscore the moment. We hear folk and gospel in the Run Freedom Run, which is the big song in Act 2. Music and dance references in the show are to The Boyfriend, Dames at Sea, Little Mary Sunshine, West Side Story, Guys and Dolls, Fiddler on the Roof, Cabaret, Annie, Chicago, Les Miserables, and even a reference to Wicked, which gives laughter and underscoring to the satire of the musical. The writers make reference to the show's lousy title, Urinetown, and the policeman, played by John Frazier, narrates with wit and deadpan. This adds a layer to the spectacle, to the fine script and excellent songs that are funny yet appropriate. I mean, there's a song called Don't Be a Bunny, which is acute yet philosophical as it talks about corporate power. With songs like It's a Privilege to Pee, we laugh and wonder what's going on here. And soon we realize that it's theater, that it's music, that it's wonderful. Just sit back and let it do its magic. Urinetown's finest moments are ensemble-drawn numbers with exuberant dance and rich choral singing in the Mark Blitzstein sort of effect. We relate to John Frazier as Officer Lopstick, the dedicated officer and narrator. Frazier brings a campy presence and works well with Ronnie Giva's Little Sally, the Annie-type little girl, who is the inquisitive child who comments on the show's action with Limestock. And Giva's got some of the funniest lines in the show. Christine Sherrill belts several tunes in her best Ethel Merman tradition as Penelope Pennywise. Fabulous name. Michael Accardo as Caldwell sells his greedy philosophy with campy humor. Tamara Spiewak as Hope Caldwell is funny and delivers her numbers with a deadpan humor and a lot of sincerity. Michael Buchanan is the cute boyish hero Bobby Strong. He expels a fine voice and great musical range, and he is convincing and sort of a low-key activist. He's the boy next door who becomes the hero. He leads the fluid ensemble of the poor folks who really make this show. This is very much of an ensemble-drawn show, who perform and land the show several energetic numbers with a tremendous amount of energy. In Urinetown, the poor folks win in many ways. The bizarre plot and crude themes only ruffle the feathers of the Broadway purists. And that's exactly what playwright Greg Kotis and his talented musical writer Michael Holman decided to do. This is in-your-face theater that will challenge your basic concepts on what makes a musical. They succeed beyond even their expectations. The show here is about pushing the boundaries that can result in a hilarious, entertaining night at the theater. Who would have thought? Shows like Urinetown are why I'm glad I get to see theater every night. This is an energetic show that is totally different. I think it'll appeal to the 20 and 30-something crowd. And some of us people who like traditional theater get a kick out of this because it's just such good satire and it's very high energy. Urinetown, it just may be playing for a long, successful run if the young, hip crowd discovers this cute, high-voltage musical. For a top ticket price of $48.50, Urinetown offers a loop-caliber show for a lot less. My rating on Urinetown? Highly recommended. It is at the Mercury Theater, 3745 North Southport in Chicago. The schedule is Wednesdays and Thursdays at 7:30, Fridays at 8, Saturdays at 5 and 8:30, Sundays at 5. The running time is 2 hours and 30 minutes with intermission. Urinetown is playing to a limited open run. For tickets, call 773-325-1700. That's 773-325-1700. Thank you. Talk to you next time. Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's review podcast. Here is my review of Loose Knit by Teresa Rebeck, directed by Tim Curtis at the Actors Workshop Theater. Loose-Knit weaves a splendid, insightful spin on personal fulfillment. Playwright Teresa Rabeck, who was the co-author of Opium Gatherum, produced last year at Next Theater, in her 1994 play, Loose-Knit, we see her comic feminist side, where she has much to say about women versus men and men versus women. Told through five middle-class 30-something women in New York City whose bond revolves around a knitting circle, Loose-Knit is a smart, satirical comedy of manners. At first, I thought this play was going to be another cliché-ridden, sitcomish, male-bashing work, but it is not. It is amazingly balanced and ultimately delivers a fresh perspective on personal fulfillment and the angst suffered by both men and women. I like the five sassy characters. From Liz, played by Carrie Corrigan, the foul-mouthed, complaining, negative, frustrated journalist who hates her sister, Lily, played by Rebecca James, whose marriage to Bob, played by Jason Daniels, has gone sour. Other members of the knitting circle are Paula, played by Dawn Perry. She is the black, self-possessed psychotherapist. Gina, played by Christine Rosencrantz, is the obsessive-compulsive lawyer who just lost her job, who becomes obsessed with being a knitter, and she's desperately and lonely. There is Marge, played by Diane Wren, who is the motor-mouth, very horny, man-chasing woman with a little bit of a dim wit. This group meets weekly to knit and to communicate their frustrations about men and their unfulfilled lives. There are cute telling moments in the knitting circle, especially when several of the girls each individually go on a blind date that has been arranged by Lily, who's the only married member of the circle. Enter the erudite, impeccably dressed multimillionaire Miles, played by Eric Hoffman, who almost steals the show. Miles, whose idea of a date is more like a job interview, as he takes notes while asking penetrating personal questions in sort of a matter-of-fact manner. His smugness, an ultra-male chauvinistic attitude, is a turn-off to these girls, despite his good looks and his obvious richness. These well-written scenes are sharp and insightful. Quote, "I like blind dates. They're like business negotiations," Miles coldly tells one of the girls. First Marge, then Paula, to whom Miles states, "This is the first time I've dated a woman of color, and I find it quite stimulating." The reaction to each date is unpredictable, and Liz jousts with the arrogant Miles in a marvelous dance of dominance that is wonderfully written and staged. Corrigan's Liz and Hoffman's Miles sparkle in these scenes. What I liked about them was the way, as dominant as the Miles character was, Liz stands up to him and sort of turns the table on him. This makes the whole play worth seeing. The complex plot has plausible twists, biting, funny dialogue as we see five women struggle to find love, companionship, and some meaning in their lives. While there are several references to the women not needing men, there is also a poignant exchange between Bob, who's cheating on his wife Lily with her sister Liz, and Miles as they lament not understanding yet needing women. Loose-Knit is a thoroughly original show filled with fine performances from the seven-member cast. I especially liked Eric Hoffman and Carrie Corrigan, and Tim Curtis's intelligent direction made the show work well. So get to the Actors Workshop Theater to see a gem of a play that once again demonstrates the value of Chicago's vibrant storefront community. Loose-Knit will leave you in stitches. My rating for this show, highly recommended. It is also a Jeff-recommended show. The Actors Workshop Theater at 1044 West Bryn Mawr in Chicago. The schedule for the show is Friday and Saturdays at 8, Sundays at 3. The running time is 2 hours and 10 minutes with intermission. It runs through April 30th. For tickets, call 773-728-7529. That's 773-728-7529. You are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's Review Podcast. Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's Review Podcast. Here is my review of Dealer's Choice by Patrick Marber, directed by Steve Scott, produced by Shattered Globe Theater at Victory Gardens. Poker comes alive in Shattered Globe's biting comic drama. Shattered Globe, one of the premier theater companies in Chicago, finds gems and lands them with verve. Their latest is an ensemble piece built around poker and gambling that antes up terrific entertainment. Dealer's Choice by British playwright Patrick Marber is a brilliant script full of witty, wisecracking drama that relentlessly probes the tortured souls of six very distinct characters. Poker players, gamblers, and those who love well-acted, crisp, razor-sharp dialogue will cherish this show. Steven, played by Doug McDade, runs a restaurant and presides over a weekly poker game in the basement of his restaurant. He enjoys playing for big money, and it's not unusual for the waiters to lose their paychecks or more each week. One of the waiters, Muggsy, played by Raymond L. Chapman, dreams of starting his own restaurant. He needs a loan, and he thinks Steven will give it to him since he intends to go into business with Steven's sons, Carl, played by Kevin Viole, and Frank, played by Brian McCaskill, a waiter, dreams of going to Vegas to be a pro poker player. Carl doesn't want any part of the restaurant and prefers to gamble away whatever money his father Steven gives him. This is a long-term problem for Carl. He's gone back and forth with his father, lying about his gambling obsession, pretending to quit, then getting deeper into debt to feed his habit. Steven tolerates Carl, but just barely. Instead, he offers fatherly love to Muggsy, a chronic loser, but a loser who refuses to give up and a loser with heart. Chapman is wonderful as Muggsy. By the end of the first act, everyone either owes money or needs money. Resentments have been stripped raw, secrets divulged, alliances shaken. The poker game that follows crackles with the scalding wit and edge-of-your-seat suspense. This play builds wonderfully. Steve Scott did a terrific job. And of course, Shattered Globe always puts together a tremendous ensemble. In Act 2, on this night, Ash, played by Nigel Patterson at his eerie best. Ash is a professional gambler. He shows up at the restaurant and threatens to kill Carl if he doesn't come up with the 4,000 quid he owes. This play, by the way, is set in London, and all the actors have a terrific Cockney, lower-class British accent. Carl could ask his father for the money again, but he's afraid to admit that he has given up on stopping gambling, that he's back at it. Instead, he invites Ash to play in the poker game with the guys, knowing he'll clean them out and hoping that he'll be able to get all the money he needs. At this high-stakes poker game, one by one the waiters drop out. Ash is confronted by Steven, who can spot a professional a mile away, but he turns the table on Steven when he asks him where Carl acquired his habit. Who is the real addict, Carl or Steven? Shaken, Steven admits that he's hooked on the game, that he loves the action. Finally knowing himself for what he is, Steven approaches Carl with a newfound need to connect with his son. The poker parts of it are not only entertaining, but they're kind of educational for those of you who don't know the moves of a poker game, but it's well played. Marber's play is remarkable, for it is a first play featuring rich, bittersweet characters. Not a bad start as a playwright. Using the motif of the weekly high-stakes poker game to speak about compulsive behavior, Marber's script descends into a dramatic unraveling of the characters. As we first met Sweeney, played with pent-up emotion by Gregory Hartigan, the cook who announces he'll not play in the game, enter Muggsy, the likable, funny mug, which is a British term for nice guy loser, the kind of character we all know. We all know a Muggsy. He dreams about winning in the poker game, but he always finds a way of losing. Raymond L. Chapman is brilliant and funny as Muggsy. Doug McDade effectively plays Steven, the restaurant owner and poker game proprietor, who is the father figure to almost all the players. McDade anchors the show with strong work, while Kevin Viole, as Steven's addicted son Carl, demonstrates the agony of the addicted gambler, while Brian McCaskill, as Frankie, the waiter, pining to leave London for Vegas, nicely rounds out the cast. McCaskill shows a lot of campy humor in this show. Nigel Patterson as Ash, the hustler, gambler, poker player, professional, who is the perfect villain with his penetrating expression and his glaring eyes. Patterson controls the game nicely. Director Steve Scott has the ensemble working together like a well-tuned auto, smooth, perfectly timed delivery of the dark humor. The personal rivalry as each suffers through the angst every compulsive gambler eventually faces. The cast goes deep into the nature of obsession, the hunger for respect from peers, and the need for mature relationships. They honor Marber's excellent writing with terrific performances. Kevin Hagen's terrific set depicts a restaurant on one side and the kitchen on the other to create an atmosphere of a London eatery. Doug McDade and Kevin Viola are moving in the poignant father-son scenes where Carl desperately seeks the recognition and respect from his father. Hartigan's Sweeney exit after losing his money sums up the pain caused by being a gambler. He goes out mumbling over and over again in a kind of a heartfelt scene. This is marvelous work. Raymond L. Chapman's Muggsy becomes the lovable loser in the hands of the skilled player like Chapman. At first glance, this play seems simplistic. Theme, poker, time frame, a few hours on a Sunday night in a London restaurant. Characters, six blokes, united by their love of gambling. Don't be fooled. This is a multi-tiered show, as much about seeking personal recognition, the thrill of achievement, and the father-son relationships as it is about poker. After seeking the action of compulsive gamblers, we know what motivates these players. On this night, old wounds flare up. Scores are settled. Winning at poker is all that matters. The only question is who will dominate. This show builds up nicely. You'll learn about poker, about addiction, about how some seek meaning in their lives, all in a marvelous production of a fine script. My rating for Dealer's Choice, highly recommended. It is at Victory Gardens Theater, 2257 North Lincoln Avenue in Chicago. The schedule for the show is Thursdays and Fridays at 8, Saturdays at 8, Sundays at 3. The running time is 2 hours and 10 minutes with intermission. It runs through May 14th. For tickets, call 773-871-3000. That's 773-871-3000. You are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's Review Podcast. Hello, you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's Interview Podcast. I'm Tom Williams, and I am up on the north side at the Actors Workshop Theater on, what's the address?
Bryn Mawr, 1044 West Bryn Mawr.
1044 West Bryn Mawr. See, I already got some help. And the reason I'm here is we are at probably the best, what I would call the quintessential storefront theater in Chicago. And I'm here with the founder of the theater, Michael Colucci, and his wife, Jan Ellen Graves, who are actors, directors, acting teachers, etc. Welcome, Michael and Jan.
Thank you, Tom.
Tell us how Actors Workshop got started.
Well, after I spent a good number of years with Ted Liss learning the craft of acting, I started auditioning around town and doing theater at various places such as Court Theater, Victory Gardens, a very young ATC, which back then was American Blues Theater. Had some really nice theatrical experiences. And because of my interest in teaching, I sort of put performing full-time on the back burner and opened up a studio. And then after that, teaching led to directing and then eventually producing a couple of shows here and there around town.
All right. And you do the Stanislavski, the method?
Yes. Yeah. My old teacher was a drill sergeant from the old school. And his whole experience in the early years of the Goodman School of Drama was learning the Stanislavski system, which, of course, morphed into the method in the 40s at the Actor's Studio with, Bobby Lewis and Cheryl Crawford and Ilya Kazan when they opened the studio in 47. And then, of course, Strasberg took that to a whole nother level with the way he worked with the method. And, you know, all kinds of different permutations eventually came to Chicago Theater in the early years of Steppenwolf and then beyond that, to the point now where it's still a very popular way to learn the craft of acting, even though there are many other techniques as well.
Would you say the method is the dominant Chicago style of acting?
I'm not sure. I think the method is the dominant style of acting worldwide, and, you know, it is the trunk of the tree, but there are so many branches with regard to Shurtleff and Meisner and Stella Adler and Uta Hagen and, you know, all kinds of different acting techniques that have been utilized, you know, particularly here in Chicago. So, you know, it's hard to say if the method is the dominant one, but it certainly is the granddaddy from which all others, I think, have emanated.
I agree. Now, tell us, you have a special rate. Well, let's get the plug in for the acting, because, folks, the caliber of shows that I have seen at your place have been terrific.
Well, thanks.
And I know a lot of the young ensemble players are students of yours. So for a young actor, let's give a little plug for the...
Well, most of the people I have been working with, you know, in the casts of our shows, with me as the director occasionally, have come through the Actors Workshop at one point or another with regard to classes.
Tell us the kind of classes you have. And I know you have some kind of a special rate.
Mm-hmm.
This is a chance for your plug. Here's your commercial.
It's a flat fee. It's unlimited classes for one flat fee per month of $100 if you use a credit card with automatic billing. So it makes it very convenient for someone to forage among the classes available and take whatever they wish, you know, whether it's commercials or industrial with ear prompter, monologue, scene study, Meisner, vocal work, etc. And it's sort of one-stop shopping with, you know, unlimited classes for that one flat fee.
Oh, great. So now you guys are also have another little distinction, Jan. You're a married couple.
Yes, we are. We've been together about 3.5 years. And actually, I first met Michael when he cast me as his wife in Broken Glass, which we first performed over at Victory Gardens before we had a space of our own. And I guess I did a pretty good job there and was convincing, because we ended up doing that in real life.
So, well, that's the ultimate rehearsal, right?
It sure is.
And tell us a little bit about your background now.
Well, I've been acting around the Chicagoland area, I guess, for about 15 years or so, and done an assortment of community and professional theater and video commercial work here and there. And I also have a graphic design business, which spills over into this work as well.
So that's where those cool logos come from.
Yeah, I do all the marketing and all the programs and posters and such. Yes, the website.
Well, I understand that you're quite a singer, that you're a triple threat. You've done your share of musicals.
Not much of a dancer, although I tap a little, but I can do a few things in all three areas.
Give us some of the musicals you were in.
Well, the ones that were most fun were the nonsense musicals.
Are cute, yeah.
Yeah, and I've done about 10 shows with Light Opera Works, and love doing Alona Ritter in She Loves Me.
That's a good role.
It is. It's a great role.
That is one of those sleeper little musicals. It is really a great show.
It is. And that's kind of my distinction, is my belt alto voice that allows me to do some of those character parts, which I don't often do when I do straight theater. I usually do the more serious. Yeah. So that allows me to have a little variety and a little fun on the musical side.
Oh, great. Okay, Michael, tell us about the latest show you have going. It's Loose Knit. And let me just add, it's one of the first shows I've seen here that neither one of you are in, nor have either one of you directed.
That's right.
So tell us how that's gone. By the way, it's a terrific show, folks. And if you click on to my review podcast, I have a review of that show up.
Mm-hmm. Well, Loose Knit by Teresa Rebeck was brought to us by an ensemble member who had a particular affinity for the show. She just simply loved it and told us that it had not really been done here in Chicago all that frequently. You know, recent contemporary plays that are very good are done all the time, since there are so many theaters here.
Tell me about it.
And there's just such a competitive atmosphere with regard to finding good material that hasn't been overdone, particularly amongst the smaller theater companies who are, you know, striving to stay in business, number one, and to emerge as a quality organization, number two. So finding the good material to produce and to, you know, develop your reputation with is not easy. In this particular case, we found a really terrific director. Tim Curtis came to us courtesy of a friend who is in the company, and it was kind of a package that was presented to us. You know, the show plus the director, and then we had some good ideas amongst our ensemble members for you know, a reasonable cast, so everything worked well.
And most of the actors that are in the show are ensemble members of, of the Actors Workshop.
Yes, among the seven cast members, five are ensemble members and two are from the outside. But one of those two we've known for many years and have a great deal of respect for her. So things are going very well.
Is this a pattern now, or is it that you guys just needed a show off to take one off? Because you've been acting in quite a few shows lately.
Well, yeah. I mean, the combination of the acting and the directing was sort of, you know, fell to us primarily because even though we have a tremendous talent within our ensemble, there is not a lot of directing experience among the younger folks in the group. So Jan and I have been around for a while, so we just have directed various shows here and there. And as a result, the directorial chores fell to us primarily. I think it just worked out that neither one of us is in this show a la actor or director. It's just, you know, it's just circumstantial more than anything.
Well, it's a testimony to your striving to produce good theater that it isn't all about you or Jan being showcased. It's about producing good theater.
Well, good. I'm glad you said that. We feel the same way. And I'm really thrilled to have Tim Curtis jump on board with us as an artistic associate.
He did a marvelous. Isn't this his first directing? I believe, isn't it?
It's his first professional directing. Yeah. I believe he's assistant directed elsewhere.
He's AD'd elsewhere, and he's done a couple of showcase things and one-act things here and there. But he himself is coming off an acting gig at Steppenwolf as an understudy for Tracy Letts
in
a well-appointed room. So he's certainly a talented and sought-after individual, and we're really fortunate to have him. You know, besides Jan and myself, in addition, we're developing a relationship with Trudy Kessler, who not only teaches a Meisner class here, but will be directing our next show, Beauty Queen of Linane. And Beauty Queen is, in my opinion, a classic over the past 10 years.
Well, I'm a big lover of Irish theater, and that is a great play.
Yeah, it really is.
Are you guys going to be in it?
Neither one of us are in that show. There's really no roles for either one of us. So I just love the show, and I wanted to direct it myself. But when I developed a relationship with Trudy as a result of the class she teaches here, I realized that, you know, not only does she have the directorial capability, the way I saw her work with actors, but she is a master at dialect.
Show is very important.
It's going to be very demanding. So she'd be much better at that than I would be. And I said, Trudy, why don't you just take the whole project? And she was very happy to do that. So, and she's, as you know, she's a woman who has been at DePaul for many years.
Yes.
And she's a real veteran and a consummate professional.
Yeah. Well, that's great.
It is.
And Jan, aren't you in a show coming up?
I'm in a show at another theater, as a matter of fact.
Well, that's all right. That's okay.
Yes, I'm doing an Agatha Christie mystery up at the Attic Theater in Highwood.
Well, that's a reason for me to go up and see that.
Thank you very much. It's actually fun to do a show elsewhere for a change where I'm not worrying about every little detail. I tend to be detail worrier.
And folks, when you come to this beautiful little storefront theater, and you could be greeted by the star, takes your ticket, and the director is the one making the coffee.
And,
I mean, it's
and then they take out the garbage after the night wraps up.
Yeah, and then you sit down and you say, "Well, this is like a little neighborhood." Then you see Top Equity Professional Theater.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
The last few shows. Tell us about the last three or four shows that you guys were in together, and where you were the director in some you were the actor and the director, and Jan, you were the. Mm-hmm. You know, give us a little dynamic on that.
Well, the past year or so has seen a couple of ups and downs. The ups, of course, were with our season of Arthur Miller, highlighted by two particular plays, one old, one new. The American Clock is a rather recent play that is a period piece about the Depression, but Miller wrote it in 1980 and Jan directed it, and it utilized nearly all of our ensemble. There were 50-plus roles played by about 20 actors. And it was a traffic cop nightmare, but Jan having a good design sense and grasp of just a certain flow, she just really...
There was a lot of music in that, if I remember.
There was a lot of music. The way Arthur Miller wrote it, he suggested music, but he didn't supply music or demand music. And so what I did is I went back to the music that my mother played on the piano, and I pulled what I felt was most appropriate for the feeling of the times. And I was just very proud to be able to use some of that.
Oh, and it worked so well. Go.
Thank you. Well, one of my specialties is transitions, and a show that has as many transitions as American Clock or a show similar to that would be Working, Studs Terkel's Working, is you don't really have a continuous storyline. And there is a storyline, certainly, but what you want to convey is a feeling and a sense of things. And one of the best compliments I got was that there wasn't a second of wasted time
in
that
show. No, there wasn't. It did flow. And that's That's our pet peeve, those of us who go to theater every night, is when shows drag.
Yes, yeah, yes.
You spend a week one night at a show. Right? But this thing really moved along, and as a big scope show on the small stage, you really made it work. It was so intimate.
Well, thank you. It was a gigantic puzzle, and I love solving those puzzles. And I had charts and graphs, and everybody knew where they were supposed to be when and how. And it was just a lot of fun. And I the people who were in it didn't quite know how it would come together, but they fortunately trusted me to get to the end.
Well, that's a testimony someone knows how to direct, that you wouldn't. The trust of your actors.
And then after American Clock, we did All My Sons shortly thereafter, and just had the pleasure of acting in it, because our lead middle-aged actor, Tom McElroy, who was in our ensemble, mm-hmm. Had a nice situation at Steppenwolf arise for him. So you can't say no to them when they call, and he took a job in their studio with Men of Tortuga, I believe.
Yes, yes.
And then as a result, the lead role in All My Sons opened up for me, and I was really the only age-appropriate person in our ensemble who could play it. And even though I had planned to direct it, I went ahead and took the role as an actor and thus did both.
The interesting thing about that show is I had done All My Sons before, and I was looking forward to doing it again, and I had done it with Tom McElroy. So we were going to be reprising our roles.
Oh,
and
okay.
I was used to his rhythm, and I was excited to be doing it in our new concept, which was everybody being in the yard with the Kellers as they watched the play. And it was quite disappointing when he couldn't make it. And I thought, well, I have no idea how this is going to work with Michael playing opposite me. Not that I can't play opposite Michael, but...
Well, how many shows have you done together before that?
Well, we did Broken Glass when we met in 2001 at the Victory Garden Studio when we were on Itinerant Company.
Okay.
And I guess we did All My Sons and then Life's Tremors here, which was a new script in our current season earlier on. I think that might be it, right?
He's directed me in other shows, but those are the only ones we performed in together.
Mm-hmm.
So now you had a triple problem with All My Sons. I mean, you are husband and wife,
right?
Which, you know, we could go into a million reasons why that has it's, problems.
Sure,
could have
certainly
problems.
A challenge.
And you were also acting in one of the major roles in that show and directing. So
right.
Tell us how this came through, because folks, it was fantastic.
Well, my directing chores had been accomplished by the time we went into the rehearsal process, because I mean, over the years, it's probably my favorite show. And I say probably because there are just so many other wonderful shows, mm-hmm. but it's at the very top of the list in the top five. And I just know the show very well, and I was prepared to direct it, years ago, because I had just simply been working on it for so long in class and in other settings. So when the time came to take the role or not take the role, I was just in a position to say, sure, I think I can handle that. And it was only because of the familiarity with the script, but it was certainly a challenge.
And I
did get an assistant director.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you have somebody to tell you when you were screwing
up?
Yeah.
Yes, by all means, because you just simply need that for your own scenes. Even though you can feel when they are working, you don't know for sure. So,
well, and you know, you're the artistic director, and some of the other, I'm sure Jan will tell you, but some of the other actors might be reluctant to say, here's the guy that runs the show. You know,
right.
He's screwing up the he's playing the scene wrong, and I ain't going to say nothing.
Well, you're right about Jan. She wouldn't hesitate to tell me, so.
But that way, all right, let's get into that dynamic. Chicago's one of the rare towns where husband and wife teams can be in shows together and can direct and be in it. This is a good town for that.
Right.
And it seems to work. I think it's, I don't know, is it the lack of ego or what?
Well, I guess our egos aren't that big.
They can't be. We have trouble paying the rent sometimes. So how full of yourself can you get under those circumstances?
Our personalities are very different. Michael is very gentle and enabling and warm, and he also has a good sense of the script and the history, and he's just very learned in those areas, and so he's the expert in that. I'm very organized and methodical and detail-oriented, and I worry...
Realistic.
Yes, I should say he's the idealist. I'm the realist. And so in terms of getting something, in terms of producing something, you need the skills of both of us to have that happen. So that's the good thing. And the bad thing is that we're often at odds with each other, because sometimes those two things really don't complement each other.
Yeah, I can see that.
So so we've argued many times. We don't really argue in front of other people.
Not often,
we'll have our little you know what I mean sort of look. But we do come out of this place and just keep talking and talking about what's going on and how it should be and how it's going to look and what.
All right, let me ask
be.
You the question that I've asked John Rieger and Paula Scarfano and other couples. Do you guys critique each other's performance? I mean, on the way home, are you saying, you know, you flubbed that line and that I don't know, you missed it, or how does that dynamic work?
You know, I don't remember saying anything besides little minor things like, could you stand a little closer next time, or we really respect one another's work on stage, mm-hmm. and we're both open to each other's suggestions on stage. We tend to talk more about the other things, like interacting with others, or, you know, do you think that they took this suggestion well, or do you think that the audience was comfortable or will be comfortable with this? So, we disagree on those sorts of points all the time. But in terms
well,
of
that's good. That's creative. but in terms of critiquing, Michael, you don't?
No, I don't think so. I mean, when I'm directing a show, I do my job as a director and give her whatever I think she needs. And if, you know, if I see she's going down a pathway I don't want her to go down, I'll say something. But we certainly do respect each other's work. And I don't remember a time when I've not directed a show when I've given her advice. I feel it's inappropriate, really. And I would respect
very
her
good.
As much as I would respect the other actors in our group if I'm not the director.
You know, so you guys are supportive. That's sure. I think that's a key to it. And by the way, that's what John Rieger and Paula Scarfano said, that they're very supportive. And again, they leave it to the director to do it. If anything, they can be supportive, where if one of them felt they didn't have a good performance that night, the other one will say, hey, you know, you really were good. I don't know why you didn't think it was there. It was there.
Right.
So that's good, because there are husband and wife teams through history of showbiz that it breaks up the marriage after a while, or they're ready to kill one another.
Well, yeah, that too. When I directed American Clock, I did ask Michael to come in. He was not in the show. I asked him to come in the day before the first preview and give me a quick eye on what could be worked on. And I probably accepted 50% of those suggestions. And I said, you know, some of those, I think they're. I want to keep that, or I wanted that.
Well,
it's
still
way.
Your
and
show,
yeah.
That's,
yeah, and
it was.
So and yeah. That was fine.
That shows how what pros you guys are to bring, you know, someone. And you could very easily have said to yourself, "Well, you know, I'm going to prove to Michael that I can direct too," you know, and not bring him in until opening night and sort of surprise him, right? Mm-hmm. I mean that would be okay.
Sure.
But in the interest of doing the work well.
Right.
You did
she chose to, you know, consult with me. And it turns out that I had some, like, about, she said, about 50% of the things I said, she just dismissed. She said, no, I'm not going to do that. Even though I said, look, I don't think you should do this. And she just said, well, I'm going to.
All right. You know, well, so. Ultimately, the director is responsible.
Right? And she turned out to be, you know, right on with that, because mm-hmm. it was a terrific show.
How uncomfortable was that for you to be able to come in there?
And it wasn't uncomfortable. You know, I feel... Ultimately, it's my responsibility in terms of anything that goes up on stage here. So,
yeah, as artistic director,
right,
yes,
right.
You are.
And I'm not a dictator with regard to the directors who come in. I give them free rein, certainly. But, you know, I appreciate her respect for my position in consulting with me, a la what, you know, winds up on stage. And I just gave, you know, whatever opinions I could, and she took them or didn't take them.
Well, you know, one of the things that I admire about you guys is the quality of the shows, the set. I'm looking at a terrific set for Loosen It. We're
in the theater.
In the theater, and the quality of the actors, it's amazing.
I agree.
Part of it is you're a heck of a teacher. You guys have good judgment on who you put in these shows.
Well. We are really blessed with a terrific ensemble. Yeah. We have about 2 dozen people in our group, and they're just really talented young actors. And some are, you know, older, 30s, 40s, 50s, yeah. But, you know, some of the younger people who are
talk about some of your people in the cast of Loosen It.
The two men, Eric Hoffman and Jason Daniels, have really grown by leaps and bounds
Eric
over
Hoffman
the past
was
year or so.
Awesome as Miles, yeah.
Yeah, it was really terrific. And he's playing such a thankless position he's playing a total bastard.
Oh, yeah.
And
one of the most handsome folks you'll see on stage.
He's really terrific.
Well, he's perfect for that role, yeah.
Yeah, he really is. And Jason, of course, has been our young leading man for a past year or two.
He's really grown a lot, hasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he was
yeah.
in Jan's American Clock as the mm-hmm. young lead, Miller's alter ego, if you will,
mm-hmm.
As the role of Lee Baum. And then he was
Chris
and All My Sons. All My,
yes.
And, you know, in Praying Small, which was a signature show of ours, a homegrown show.
Talk about that, too. Yeah.
Well, he was he played the protagonist of that play about substance abuse. And it was a role that he himself might not have felt quite ready for. But having witnessed his growth over the past year or two prior to that, said, you know, Jason, you're really ready for this role. And he just stepped in and did a great job with it.
That was Praying Small.
Praying Small, yeah.
Tell us about Praying Small, because it's one of the works I know you guys are proud of.
Well, we are. And Cliff Moritz, a terrific writer who had moved to Chicago from New York City back in 2002, shortly after we moved in here. It's funny, we got married in September, moved in here October, in the same, you know, back-to-back months of that same year, and then things began here. And Cliff wound up on our doorstep in November. And by the time we, you know, got to know him over the course of the next month or so, he brought a script to us because it would be good for classwork, because most of the scenes were two-person scenes. Mm-hmm. So it would be great for scene study. And we read the play and said, well, you know, not only is this good for classwork, but we should really produce the play. And that was our first play here. It was our inaugural production, and it was really a terrific play, and it was a Critics' Choice in the Reader, and really got us off to a jump start.
Well, we were so proud of it. We actually remounted it again in the middle of the Miller season because, yeah, we felt that we didn't get the broader audience that we could have the first time because it was our first production.
And nobody knew we were here.
What it did allow us to do was actually convert this office space into a theater and, you know, and make our mark with a really good piece. And then we remounted it again to get more exposure. And we contacted all the substance abuse organizations within 50 miles and offered free tickets to them. And we were hoping to take it on a tour. That never panned out. But we feel we got some good exposure. And
we had some groups here who came in to see the show among the substance abuse
good.
Community, you know, AA groups and things like that. So that we felt it was, you know, socially.
But you're open to that if that could come together, the touring that. Because
oh, sure.
I think it's the kind of show that should be played in the high schools and in the colleges in the area.
I agree.
I really do.
Yeah, I agree. And just today, in fact, something in the mail came through from a young woman who is seeking a position for community outreach for social plays mm-hmm. to help high schoolers and things like that.
Oh, this is perfect.
With regard to issues of sex, drugs, and things like that. So I was very intrigued by all that because that's one thing we're very interested in, community outreach.
All right, let's talk about what it takes to run a storefront theater. The ups and downs of it, because Chicago is well known for it, and you know, a lot of them come and go. The typical scene was kids right out of college, they get together and they rent a storefront and they start doing they last, you know, two or three shows because they have no business sense or they don't. You know, they start fighting among themselves, and it disappears. And some promising groups have, but you know, you guys have you've survived a while, and tell us about how the dynamics of it.
Well, we're in the fourth year now of a 5-year lease, and we have an option for 5 more. But when I signed the contract 3 and a half years ago, I just thought that if I could just simply keep the place open for 5 years and build a foundation of good work, that would allow us to continue long term, wherever that may take us, mm-hmm. and it may take us only as far as continuing to be a pretty darn good storefront theater. But who knows where we might go beyond that. Some people in the ensemble might go on to much bigger and better things. We ourselves might continue to do really good work and grow to the point where, even though we'd like to retain our intimate status, we'll be a really strong, viable theater company. But in answer to your question, the two things I think it requires are just a commitment to keep the doors open and a commitment to quality work, i.e., you have to pay the bills and you have to keep producing. Those have been my two big things. And if you're not interested in spending $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 a month simply to keep the doors open, you're really not going to survive. And even though that might not sound like a lot of money, the months tick off pretty quickly.
Oh, yeah.
And you just simply have to pay that nut of $3,000 or $4,000 minimum, even if it's a small storefront like this. Wherever you get the money, you know, whether it's the classes that generate some of our income, but not really a lot, or any contributions that you might get from among the ensemble, some people do contribute, and then, of course, outside contributions, and, of course, box office. So all of those, you know,
are you guys a non-for-profit?
We are.
Okay.
So all those sources
of
revenue.
So you're qualified. You qualify for the grants and so
forth. Yeah, we
for.
Do. And, okay. You know, as a young company, we really don't have that grant-writing apparatus, you know, finely tuned just mm-hmm. yet. We certainly hope to get into the regular
How about subscription?
Cycle.
Do you have a subscription base?
We do, but our base, our patron base is quite nice and growing, but the subscription base is not, you know, that of an established theater company.
The subscription base is a bit of a problem because when we ran into that with All My Sons, which required us extending it because we had people begging for seats, it just we were filling it every night and we could have gone on for quite some time, and that bumped into the next show we had planned. So when you plan a season worth of shows, you commit publicly to people that they're going to see all those shows, and you try as hard as you can to do that. You have to get rights and all that, and certainly those sorts of things can fall through.
So it's a two-edged sword,
yeah.
Because if you get a hit that could run, well, isn't there a way in between that, or is it not?
Well, you know, many theaters just plan the one show at a time, and then they perform it as long as it works for them. And there's certainly some well-known theaters that will do that. And then if it doesn't go so well, they close it and go on to their next project. They know what their next project is, but their patrons do not. So it's a little hard to develop a subscriber base because we haven't quite come up with the rhythm. We wanted to do 5 shows a year and add a few more off-night productions. Maybe that's too ambitious. Maybe with a hit, it's certainly too ambitious if we extend a show. So it's really hard to determine that. There's a lot, when you ask what it takes to do theater, the business end of it, I think, is a big stumbling block for those young people that come out of school and want to put on a play. And it's certainly a stumbling block for us because we enjoy performing and directing.
But you guys, you know, you're the heart and soul of Chicago theater. This is where it happens in the storefront.
Well, you know, and we've tried to actually market that. One of our focuses for one of the shows was to simply represent ourselves as as come and see Chicago storefront theater at its best. And we did that at all the hotels and all the, and you know, it's funny, we didn't get a single response out of that. And that doesn't mean that's not a good idea. We might not have timed it correctly or promoted it in just the right way. But yeah, we do think that we're a good storefront theater, and we need to dispel the notion that we're only a training place, because I think the name Actors Workshop implies that we're just, you know, doing scenes and workshop productions, and that's not the case at all. That comes from his school and the name.
Well, I think you branded the name, and quite frankly, I didn't come see a couple of your shows when I first started reviewing because I thought you were just doing scenes. Because once I did come, and I'll tell you how I got there, Rosalind Alexander called me at my house. And it's rare that I get an actor to call me. But I've known her a while, and everything she's such a pro.
Oh yes.
And she was doing what was the Miller?
Last Yankee.
Yeah, The Last Yankee, where she did the little tap dance.
Right.
And when I came out and I met you guys and I saw what you're doing, I said, wow. I think I even said that in my review. You know, this is not just a kid storefront. This is professional theater in a small intimate atmosphere. So I hope, if nothing else out of this podcast, that our listeners realize that you guys are real, you are professional. This is an equity house on most of your shows, and you guys are consummate pros, because I think that'll help quite a bit.
Well, that's very nice. Thank you. Yeah. And you've been very supportive, so we really appreciate
that. Well, I try and do that. You know, I love going to see the big stuff, but I'll tell you, my heart and soul is discovering small theater groups and excellent plays. I think that's what makes my job not a job, makes it fun.
Well, we love meeting our audience. That's something you get to do here that is really wonderful. People come back, oh, I remember when you did this, and I just love that, and I can't wait to see the next one. And when they call and make a reservation, they actually talk to Michael, and they've developed a friendship of a sorts when they get him on the phone.
They usually answer the phone.
They don't get a recorder. They get him, and he's so great on the phone. And so anyway, we welcome people into our space. They often get to sit on couches and watch shows. They get to bring in their drinks.
What is your ticket price generally?
Well, right now it ranges, it's $20 to $25 for this show. We have discounts for groups, and we have discounts for
industry
seniors
people.
And industry.
I mean, when you consider that a lot of the equity companies are $45, $50, $60 tickets.
And they've got a ton of seats. Yeah, right now for this show, we have 30 seats. And so if you want to see Loose Knit that goes till April 30th, you have to reserve because just aren't many places.
Well, Jan, give us the phone number.
Okay. It's a 773-728 play, or if you don't like dialing the letters.
Now give me the numbers.
773-728-7529. And that's Friday, Saturdays at 8 o'clock, Sundays at 3, now through April 30th. Loose Knit, a comedy. And as Tom said in his review, Loose Knit will leave you in stitches.
I couldn't resist it. And
Hedy Weiss said about the American clock, this clock really ticks.
Yes, she did.
So that was her kicker in her review.
That's true. That's true. And that's why I try and get my reviews up quicker so that I'm not, if anything,
they're stealing from you, right?
Well, and we're not. Most of us never read another review until we finish ours. That's kind of the rule of thumb.
Sure, that makes sense.
But I'll tell you guys, you really do a terrific job. Now, tell us what the future is going to be for you guys.
Well, we're in the process of developing plans for our 06-07 season. A Miller season, of course, was last year. This season has been sort of a blend of various, world premieres, brand new works, and some, established plays with, Beauty Queen and Loose Knit. And outside directors, Peter Forster has worked with us. Trudy Kessler will be working with us.
We have
Tim Curtis with Loose Knit. And then next year, we have some, for example, there's a new playwright who was commissioned by Nicholas Heitner over at the National in London to write another play after the one that we shall be doing as the U.S. premiere this summer called Proving Mr. Jennings. The playwright is James Walker, and George Cedarquist, who is the artistic director of Steep Theater, is going to be directing the play. And George is really a talented young man.
Oh, yes,
I think he's still in his 20s. He's a Yale grad.
Yeah.
He's going to be a director here in the summer of Proving Mr. Jennings, written by James Walker, who is a rising young playwright. So we're really excited to have this project.
You think he's going to be here?
I wouldn't be surprised.
If he does, let me know, and we'll get an interview.
Oh, that'd be terrific.
Because I love to interview playwrights too.
Yeah,
particularly with
he's
new work.
He's a talented guy, and the play is about the anxiety and the fear with which we're all suffering concerning this postmodern age of terrorism. So it's a dark, dark comedy and pokes fun at some of the various categories of the bureaucratic structure that is trying to deal with this issue. So,
are you going to be in the show?
I don't think so. There's a couple of roles in it for some 30-somethings and 40-somethings, but I'm just over the edge on that. So
by a couple days, right?
We'll see.
Wow.
You mentioned, I was just thinking, is he going to be in the show on that? And you asked us about our ensemble. One of the things is we have a variety of ages in our ensemble. So
yes, I noticed it.
Most of the shows can use a portion of our ensemble. Throughout the year, we always hope to showcase everyone in it at least once. And we've been pretty successful at doing it. But one of the reasons that I think you see pretty good work up here, in addition to good training and good understanding of the text and all, and diligent work, is that we all get along together. That everybody likes everybody else. We don't have this, the Steppenwolf historic battles between people.
So I can't get any good stories about
you
guys.
You can't get any of that from here.
It's not a soap opera yet. We've only been around together for 3 or 4 years. So.
But, really people like each other. They have fun together. They trust each other. They are getting used to working with each other and sensing rhythms, reading body language. And that really shows on stage, I think.
Yes. Well, Abandonment, which is a show that I really liked. If I remember right, you guys let me come to a preview.
That's right.
And I was amazed at how polished the show was. Was testimony to the direction and to the commitment of the actors. I mean, it was. If you had told me that show had been running a couple of weeks, I would have believed it.
Yeah, David Kropp was the director for that show, and he really did a great job with the actors. I thought it was a really wonderful production. So,
now let me ask you the one question that comes up. That show got hurt by some negative reviews and folks. I would argue with those people because the show was terrific. Do reviews hurt small theater more than, let's say, the big guys?
I think so, sure. Yeah. The big guys have a subscription base and they'll get their, patronage from that built-in mechanism.
They have national recognition, too. When someone comes to Chicago,
yeah, they'll go to Steppenwolf for Goodman. Yeah.
Yeah, the name brand will be the theater company's name itself as opposed to the show. You know, oftentimes we have to rely on the name brand recognition of a play, and neither Abandonment nor Actors Workshop Theater had that. Mm-hmm. So with the negative reviews, even though it was a pretty good show,
well, I mean, and, know, I'm not, and I'm not,
it didn't do that.
The reason I wanted to bring that up is because I don't, sometimes my colleagues don't realize that they can really hurt a show. If I rip a Broadway in Chicago show or a Steppenwolf show or Chicago Shakespeare, I'm not going to have any effect.
No, of course not.
But if I put out a fast review of your show and just rip it apart, at least those people who come to my site every day might say, well, geez, if he doesn't like it, we're not going to go.
Well, when you put yourself out publicly, you certainly are open to all sorts of criticism and compliments and critiquing. There's, you know, we understand that part. And
yeah,
we
you're
hope,
charging money, so you're
sure,
fair game.
Sure,
sure. Yeah,
and we hope that people will take a look at the work we do and critique it in that vein. We've noticed that people seem to focus on things that are outside our control, like who did the role 20 years ago, or the writing of the play, and that it's dated, and those may be true, but it doesn't have anything really to do with the production that's going on here, and maybe why we chose to do it or what we're trying to say with the production. So we found a lot of reviews will headline with something that has nothing to do with this production, and that
I've
that
been
really
there,
throws
and I really tried to learn that you have to judge not what the play could have been or should have been, but what the play is and what you were attempting to do and how well you did it. That's the only way I can evaluate a show. You know,
no.
I think that's unfair.
Every theater has their own reason for doing it, and it should be judged in that arena.
Well, I think that. And I hope this helps. I think as the Actors Workshop Theater gets recognition of being a group of professionals who do high quality work, I think you'll also be in a status where you'll get the A-list people to come out to review the show, which I think will make a difference.
We hope so. And we've actually had some success at that. And what always surprises me, it's hard. Marketing is another business aspect that's really hard to theater.
But it's okay to comment on it, because a lot of our listeners of these podcasts are in the theater community, the young kids who are starting out in theater, and they love to hear the advice.
Sure, and you have to get the word out, and you have to keep telling people and reminding people and be a nag. And sometimes people let you know that you're being a nag, but you do have to get the word out. What surprises me, though, is that we've had some success at getting people, reviewers, out to see our shows, and you were speaking about the A-list. We've gotten the A-list out, and when we have, they've loved, not said it was okay, they've loved our shows. But the surprising thing is, they don't come back. And if I had seen a really, 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 really great show that I keep talking about, that show, I think I'd see another production that the company was doing.
And, you know, that's how, but I think in March, when you guys sent me the press release, Actors Workshop, I got to see it. By the way, somebody asked me, what's the show? You know, until the day of the show, I didn't know the name of your show, because I bet on the groups. If I'm picking the groups, and again, if there's five openings on a day, I'm going to go in the order of the strength of the group.
Sure.
Obviously, I'll go with the big guys.
Right.
Yeah, but once you're down into the thing where it's marginal, which one you're going to go to, the judgment is the strength of the group. Great.
Sure. And I think the public relies on reviewers to go see a lot of stuff so that they can distill what they should go and see. That's why they look at these reviews. And so
that's the only reason they come to my site, is they want to see a show and they want to get a little guidance, or at least, you know, what I think of the shows. Now, I think you guys with your younger cast have a younger base of audience too, don't you?
Yeah, we have a large ensemble, so our extended circle of family and friends amongst all of the 20-somethings and 30-somethings in our group, has quite a number of younger people. And then, of course, we have neighborhood folks, and so it's a mix. I mean, we have some of the folks in the neighborhood have been around for years, and they're seniors, so we really have a good mix here, actually.
That's good. Do you have an industry night or anything like that?
Every day. I mean, every performance, I should say. And that, space permitting, we just have an industry rate. of $15 as opposed to the ticket price of
$25. Oh, that's good.
So it's a $10 discount anytime.
Well, I'll tell you, for the younger actors and the people who want to get into theater, just coming to your shows and seeing what you guys do is the audition for not only good entertainment that night, but to get in your school.
Actually, there's a member of our ensemble that actually came to one of our shows, and Michael talked to her, and what you do on industry night is bring your picture and resume, and they chatted, and when it came time to cast for another one of our shows, Michael said, you know, I think I know who would be perfect for that role. And he just met her that night when she came and saw one of our previous shows and called her in, and son of a gun, she was perfect for that role.
Yeah, she was all my sons, and now she's actually an ensemble member. So,
well, tell us what the future is 5 years from now. Where do you think you guys will be?
I wouldn't be surprised if we're still in the Edgewater neighborhood. I expect to be open and thriving at that point. I don't think we'll have to close our doors. I wasn't so sure about that over the past year or so, but now I think we're going to be around for a while, long term, and the place might even outlast me and Jan and be a cultural force here in the Edgewater community, which is really undergoing a beautiful revitalization.
Yes, it is. You have City Lit down the block, who does a different kind of shows than you do, but the two of you guys can help this Bryn Mawr and
right on the main drag in this neighborhood, and it's really going in the right direction. You know, anytime you have a Francesca's and a Starbucks and a White Hen, you're in pretty good shape.
Yes, that's for sure. All right, in the last few seconds we have, give a promo for the show, the title and ticket price and the phone number.
Well, Loose Knit, a really dark urban comedy about love and life and relationships with a bunch of young people trying to find their way in the world and failing quite a lot, but then ultimately having some redeeming value in terms of the growth that they experience by the end of the story. Teresa Rebeck is a noted writer of this genre of plays, and she's quite well respected among the younger acting community. So she's really
engaging. What days does the show?
It's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Friday and Saturday at 8 and Sunday at 3 o'clock.
Okay. And what phone number? 1044 West Bryn Mawr.
Correct.
Right off the Bryn Mawr Red Line.
Yeah, just a block or two east of the Bryn Line walking toward the lake. The Bryn Line? The Red Line.
The Red Line.
Walking toward the lake. And
what's the phone number for tickets?
773-728-7529.
Once more.
728-PLAY.
728-PLAY. Well, thank you, folks. This has really been terrific. And folks, get out to see the play and meet these people. And the actors, bring your photo. You never know if you'll end up in a play.
Great.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, there you have it. Another encouraging episode from Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast, brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. But before I let you go, it's time for your Shakespeare quote of the week. The following quote comes from Measure for Measure, Act 2, Scene 1. 'Tis one thing to be tempted, Aeschylus, another thing to fall. Thank you very much for listening in on this encouraging episode of Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Remember, we are here every Monday with a whole new episode ready for your ears. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.